Hey guys, James Cox, and I'm here with an interview with Angel and Light Flynn. They're the founders of an organization called Gentle World, and really focuses on veganism, and wanted to learn more about the work that they do in terms of promoting veganism and kind of the challenges that they've run into. So Angel and Light, thanks for taking the time to chat today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thanks for having us on, James. I just want to make the note that while Light is the founder of Gentle World, he actually founded it with his late wife's son, who passed away a few years ago. They founded it back in 1980, 81. And I'm the outreach director. I joined in about 22 years ago. So I don't want to take credit as being a founder, but Light, who I'm here with, he certainly founded this organization. He's a
Gotcha.
52-year vegan.
Awesome. So 22 years the organization has been around. So that says a great deal about, where things have come and how long you've been in the trenches. So tell us a little bit about how did you guys get into the work that you do in terms of promoting veganism and being able to, sustain yourselves doing so.
Well, I guess I should start with a little background. My background goes to the what's known as the medieval period. I started out in Brooklyn, New York. You may have heard of it. And when I was 12, my parents divorced, and my mother, a year later, remarried a hotel owner from the resort hotels called the Catskills, about 85 miles north of New York City. And it was there that I met my future wife. And while we were rising in love, and I use that term with meaning because there's nothing falling about being in love, it's all rising. And we decided that we were going to seek the truth, and not only seek it, but when we found it, we were going to live it. That was the big difference, not just seeking it. And about the next 2 weeks, we happened to go to a movie in which, I'm not sure, I think it was called Mondo Cane, which is a dog's life. And they were showing the insanities of the world, like dueling societies, and just it was easy to find insanities in the world. And one of them was four grown men, four big men with sledgehammers hitting a bull over the head after a bullfight. And the poor creature was screaming, and it took him a good 10 blows to go down to his knees, and eventually they killed him. My wife and I came out of the theater and said, "Is that how they get meat? Well, there's a truth we found. We can't do that anymore." And we stopped eating meat. About a year later, we went to a dairy to look into that in upstate New York. And of course, they want you to go where they want you to go, like all inspections. But we decided to go behind the scenes. And of course, we heard the mothers bawling. We couldn't understand why they were screaming and crying. And of course, the woman said, "Well, they take their baby away, but don't worry, they stop in about 3 or 4 weeks and you get
My
used to
God.
it." Yeah. Well, that was the end of dairy. And we
And
bought
what
it
year was this?
1970.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. It's even
Yeah.
wower to me. So,
yeah, this was before factory farms. You know, it wasn't like an
Yeah, that's
industrialized thing. It was by
no.
now known as a small family farm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This was before everything. There was no tofu, never heard of it, no health food stores. We thought actually we never heard the word vegan at the time, nor had anyone else we knew. And we thought we kind of invented, we knew about vegetarianism, but we didn't know about not eating or using leather or silk or fur or any of that. We kind of thought we invented it in our egotism at the time. And it wasn't until a couple of years later that we met another who knew it was called vegan. It was unheard of in the United States. It was originated in the UK, and they may have known of it, but I don't think so. Certainly not in the US. But, so anyway, I have a perspective that the most important part of my 50-year perspective that a younger person doesn't have. Younger people feeling a little hopeless sometimes when they see, pardon me, it hasn't changed. I better have some tea. But it's the most hopeful thing I see on this planet, because I can see over the 50 years where it went from total obscurity to familiarity. Pretty much everybody knows what vegan means now. Mm-hmm. They used to pronounce it vegan. But now they know. I see where they even have in what they call fast food places now. Mm-hmm. That's my most hopeful thing in this whole planet, is to see the changes in, especially in young people, because nowadays, where they have the internet, which of course we didn't have in 1970, they see what's going on. They can punch up a scene of a slaughterhouse. Mm-hmm. By the way, the slaughter, and the whole word should be exorcised from English. We should never have to use the word cruel, or that it's cruel, or it's a slaughterhouse. And yet the people accept those terms like they're normal.
Well, they also accept the term humane slaughter, which what kind of an Orwellian phrase is that, you know? That's insane.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely.
Yeah, Orwell was way ahead of his time.
He was. Him and Huxley both.
Both of them, yeah. And it's getting a little more frightening now in that direction. Mm.
So when you founded Gentle World about 20-something years ago, what was the motivation to found an organization called Gentle World?
Well, it was actually a little over 40 years ago.
40 years ago, okay.
Yeah, it's just that Angel, who's much younger, obviously, I would expect, has been here 22 years. But no, we founded it. Well, for one thing, we had to stop eating. My parents thought I was going to die, thought we were going to die, because we weren't going to get protein, which in those days, they didn't know that protein existed in pretty much everything that's green. Uh-huh. And in their desire to keep us alive, my mother, who was a chef in a hotel business, would sneak meat to prot, like meat gravy and things, to try to give us protein. And we had to stop eating her food. And then eventually we had to stop eating with people who were chewing on the leg of a chicken or a turkey or the hoof of an animal. And eventually we had to kind of withdraw from that society. And we found other people who, not a lot at the time, but a good handful. At one time, the commune had, at the peak, it had 35 people, all vegan, of course. Even our dogs were vegan from the very beginning. They still are, by the way.
So you founded a commune. Where was this at?
Well, we founded the commune in Florida because of back then, of course, and even now, it was easier to live there since they had no winter, and they had a lot of flea markets, which really helped when we were a little money destitute at the time.
Yeah, it was 1981 when Gentle World produced a recipe book, because at that time they were, spreading the word of veganism, trying to share the message of veganism. And a big part of it was they realized that they had to make the food really good, because a lot of people back then, you know, there was no, when you took the meat and the cheese out, everything was tasting bland, until they realized, okay, no, let's try and make this taste good and make foods that people are familiar with and that they can enjoy. And so it started out with developing food. As far as the organization goes, it turned from a commune into a nonprofit educational organization, because they made their vegan outreach, an official program through recipes, a cookbook, cooking classes, seminars. And that's how it evolved from being an intentional community into a nonprofit 501c3. Yes. And that's what's existed for 41 years.
Yeah, as I mentioned, my mother was a chef, and I knew what good food was. And when we ate any vegan meals, they were so bland, we knew nobody would switch from what they were eating with such bland food. And we became the food people, which eventually turned into a restaurant on Maui, where, by the way, you know how McDonald's says a billion served? a billion served, which is really not something to be proud of. We had over our door a million saved, which at the time I thought was kind of clever and, of course, very honest.
Yeah, the whole restaurant was filled with messages about veganism, quotes from people throughout history about not eating animals, you know, on every table, on the menu. They had just all sorts of outreach information to help people understand what this vegan thing is all about.
Yeah, well, keep in mind, nobody knew the word vegan. We named the restaurant the vegan. We named our first dog vegan. We wanted people to be familiar with the term and to know what it meant. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to imagine now when you see vegan stamped on food in the supermarket, which, by the way, that, you know, I see a lot of young people that they kind of feel hopeless because it's still going on. But the truth is, when you have a 50-year perspective like I have, you see the changes that have occurred, such as stamping things in the supermarket vegan.
Yeah.
And all the change, and even have that in these fast food places, they now have vegan choices.
Yeah.
It's the most hopeful thing I see in this certifiably insane world where now they're even talking about nuclear war. Yeah. You gotta have a sense of humor or you would cry all the time. They're talking about nuclear war. They think that neo-Nazism, they think that was a good idea in the first place.
Yep.
Wanna repeat it. Aye.
So, yeah, a lot of changes, especially over the past 2 years. I think the advent of plant-based food products to replace meats, like Beyond Meat or Impossible Burger. There's a whole host of companies that have come out to produce plant-based foods that really act as replacements for any of the meats that are out there, so that you really wouldn't even, from a taste perspective, if you're a carnist, you wouldn't even notice, you know?
Absolutely so, exploding. The vegan market is absolutely exploding.
Well, the last thing we could get that was pizza. And nowadays they have melting cheese, which.
Yeah, exactly.
And now they have seafood and they have fried
now
eggs.
They have delicatessen, I just heard.
Yep. I had vegan crab cakes today for lunch. So.
Really?
But one thing I think that has happened is the awareness of the word has exploded for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But the meaning of the word, I think there's some confusion now that didn't exist maybe in the past, you know, as far as this whole thing of people thinking that veganism is a diet.
Mm-hmm.
And it's helpful to actually have the term plant-based to kind of differentiate between those two things. Veganism is not just food and what we eat. It's not the same as, you know, a more extreme version of vegetarianism, for instance. I mean, veganism is a much bigger thing than that. And I think that's something that, you know, the early pioneers, Light and Sun and Donald Watson and Jay and Freya Dinshaw, they were coming from such a strong ethical stand. That's what the word originally meant. It wasn't just about diet. It wasn't even just about lifestyle. It was this very broad, overarching philosophy, a worldview of how we see ourselves and our relationship with the other animals who we share the planet with. And I think that's something that, you know, for me, when I met Gentle World and met Light and Sun and heard their story of becoming vegan in a time when they really didn't know that it was even a thing, you know, they just kind of learned the truth about what was going on. For me, it really helped me to understand that this is a much deeper, much more significant thing than I think maybe a lot of these ideas that are kind of trendy about, you know, veganism to lose weight or veganism to be hip and cool or all of that really misses out on, and I hope to see a renaissance of that in the coming time.
Ahimsa is the word. I think it's Sanskrit, but ahimsa is to do no harm. It's like the Hippocratic Oath.
Yeah. Well, it reminds me, it's like taking nonviolence to another level beyond that. You know, it's even more than nonviolence. It's actively resisting against violence, you know? So.
Yes, and nonviolence is such a critical facet of what this is all about. And I think a lot of people, again, are missing out on that. you know, what that, how deep that really is for us, you know, spiritually, societally, as a culture, as individuals, as a human family. It's very rich. It's a very rich concept. And in fact, Jay Dinshaw, who founded the US Vegan Society, the American Vegan Society, wrote a book called Out of the Jungle very early on. I don't even know what year he published it, but it was all about that concept of ahimsa and how veganism is a living, you know, living expression of ahimsa. It's a beautiful book. And if people haven't read it, not so easy to find nowadays, but it's an excellent treatise on veganism as ahimsa in action.
I have to check that out. I'm curious, you both have seem like you have traveled a good bit. How is violence towards in society towards animals different in the United States as opposed to like Europe or other parts of the world? Like, is like the American version more violent than in other parts of the world? Are we like all in the same, cut from the same cloth, so to speak? Or, you know, how are there differences?
Well,
culturally,
not too many, I'm afraid. They all mistreat animals. I'm told that Germany and Israel are the most vegan countries, which personally, this is just a thought of mine, that's based on the guilt from both of them. Of course, the guilt for the Germans for the obvious, what they did. And then there's the guilt of the young Israelis who are perpetrating
their own genocide.
Their own, which is hard for me. I spent some time there, and I used to say to them, you bring them in, bring the Arabs in and make them part of it. Not, don't carry around guns. But of course, they didn't listen, obviously. Mm-hmm. It's the world's in a sad shape. And the only hope I see is veganism, because it's a spiritual change that lives the golden rule, which is attached to every religion in the world. It's simple. Do unto others what you would mm-hmm. do to yourself. That's reasonable enough.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I know, there's nothing more reasonable than veganism. And it's the only thing I see moving forward. Most other things, like the war going on now, is moving backwards. The only thing I see moving forward, and I'd like to tell that to young people who look at it after being vegan for 2 years and say, well, there's no change. Oh, I can see in 50 years, believe me, there's been a great change. Mm-hmm. And not great enough, obviously, until they do away with killing. As long, you know, Tolstoy said, as long as there are, Tolstoy, way back then, he said, as long as there are slaughterhouses, there will be wars, because people survive on killing. Mm. And so they do, they think killing is okay.
Well, it's the society that socializes it. And I mean, really, that's kind of what we have been handed in terms of with the economy, that the way that it's developed, and we're socialized to think that that's normal, when in fact it doesn't have to be that way. You know, all these are self-inflicted wounds, basically.
Yeah.
There was an old cartoon, I think it was called Pogo, in which Pogo said, I don't know if you remember, that goes back a long way, but mm-hmm. Pogo said, we have met the enemy and they is us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, a lot of, even especially a lot of the health related issues, there was actually a video put out by Cory Booker, who himself is a politician in the Senate, is vegan and, you know, very public about it in terms of promoting it. And he had put out a video actually today about the upcoming farm bill. And the fact that so many subsidies go into animal agriculture and mm-hmm. into subsidizing the slaughter, that if we just took a small fraction of money to subsidize giving people free fruits and vegetables, mm-hmm. their health would dramatically improve. you know, and the bang for the buck, so to speak, would be exponential in terms of people's life, ability to live a healthy life, but it just makes sense. And yet what we're forced to deal with is a system that does not operate based on good sense. It works on based on dollars and cents.
That's right.
I'm afraid so.
These are huge economic powers that we're talking about. The animal industry is gigantic, and they have huge, huge sway over legislation and the food guidelines, the nutrition guidelines. They've always got their hands in there telling the politicians what to say. And I mean, even if they took that money, like you're saying, and took some of it and just brought the price down of fruits and vegetables, just that alone, just make it more affordable for people to go in and buy produce. It's so unfair that people growing the you know, genetically engineered soy to feed the cows and corn that makes corn syrup and all of that stuff, they're getting all the handouts, and the junk food is cheap as can be, and healthy food is you know, too expensive for some people. That's it's inhumane.
It's a lot cheaper than doctors and hospitals.
It is, but it's a devil's bargain, so to speak. You know, it's you got to make severe choices. And of course, now we're going through a period of climate change where food is going to become more of a challenging situation based on rising temperatures. And we have to be smarter about what we're doing overall. And it just doesn't make any sense to, like you said, why are we devoting all of this agriculture to syrups and to feeding animals and to things that are just not good for us? It just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. Global warming, now that you mention, that's another, that's enough. You know, veganism is a panacea. People don't like that word because it includes everything, but it's true. It's good.
It is true.
There's nothing it's negative about, whether it's your health or that it's the planet. You know, when all these people talk about saving the planet and they don't mention that animal agriculture accounts for more pollution in the air than all the trucks and buses and planes and everything else put together, and they never mention that. There's something about that that makes them seem a little disingenuous, shall I say, if not downright lying.
Exactly.
Yeah, you asked about other parts of the world, and I grew up in New Zealand, and Junta World actually has a center in New Zealand. We haven't been able to go for a number of years due to COVID and some other factors, but there was an excellent documentary just released out of New Zealand called Milked. I don't know if you have had the chance to see
it. I've seen the ads for it, but I haven't seen it yet.
It's so good. It's really well done, and it's very up to date, which, you know, is just important for documentaries, because I think a lot of times if you show depictions of what's going on in the animal farms and this and that, people think either that's not happening now, things have been made better somehow magically, or they think, in the case of a place like New Zealand, that's not how it happens in my country, right? That's in the US, they have these huge big industrialized farms, but here in New Zealand we do it better, we treat our animals better, this and that. Milked really pulls the, you know, the takes that illusion away. And it was horribly saddening, you know, for me as a New Zealander, because it's just talking about how the country has just been, that the nature, the natural world of New Zealand has been absolutely devastated by the dairy industry there. Just rivers polluted everywhere. They're pouring nitrates onto the soil to make the grass grow so they can put more cows onto a smaller area of grass. And everything from that to the farmers, you know, farmers committing suicide, because the truth is it's no good for the farmers either. They get caught into a, you know, essentially a kind of servitude type situation to the industry itself. But it was an excellent documentary. And I think it really speaks to your point of, you know, how different is it in different parts of the world? And of course, the documentary Earthlings, which is one that we try to show to anybody who's kind of holding out and not making the vegan transition. It's like, okay, well, sit down and watch this and see if you're still going to resist. They show a whole thing in India of how the cows are taken for leather And they're not, there's laws in India against slaughtering cows because they're, you know, considered sacred. But these leather merchants come and buy sacred cows, families' sacred cows, the one cow that they keep, you know, as their sacred cow. And they're not allowed to slaughter them in India. So they take them on this death march to Pakistan or somewhere else where they're allowed to do the slaughtering. And honestly, in some ways, it's even worse. I mean, it may not be the huge industrialized, you know, just factory concentration camps that that we're starting to learn so much about now. But, you know, the fact is anywhere that, and this is all over the world, when animals are viewed as commodities, when they're viewed as objects for our consumption, it creates this automatic viewing of them that they, that their feelings don't matter. And it's not just with the farmers, the entire population has somehow convinced themselves that their feelings don't matter. We couldn't keep doing what we do to them mm-hmm. if we took their feelings into consideration. So it's like this mass delusion that the population is under, that they don't feel like we feel. And as long as you can go along believing that, all sorts of atrocities will be committed towards these beings everywhere in the world, because we're just denying the reality of the fact that they're sentient beings. They feel like we do, both, you know, physically and emotionally.
Yeah. I mean, when life has no value, when you're not valuing the lives of the animals, the reality is you're not going to value the lives of people either. And it, you know, it creates the system that just reinforces itself. So it really requires people to look deeper into themselves to really ask the hard questions. And like you said, I mean, that the hopeful thing, and I think it is hopeful as well, that there's been so much growth in terms of awareness of the issue of, and the, that viewpoint over the past couple of years, especially, that it is frankly pretty hopeful, you know, given all the other things that we have going on in the world that we're dealing with. It's really a beacon of hope.
It is a beacon of hope. And I think that one thing that might help people who are feeling hopeless or despairing is to recognize that it's like so many things in the world, there's a polarization going on, and the things that are bad maybe getting worse. I mean, like the war, the escalation of the war and all of that, these terrible things are getting worse. And yet somehow on the other side of that, humanity, the part of humanity that is awakening, is accelerating. So the knowledge about veganism expanding mm-hmm. is an example of that, where mm-hmm. our consciousness is actually, you know, growing and expanding and heightening at the same time that the worst of things, the bottom end, is getting worse. Yeah. So if you look just at the bottom end, it looks like it's getting worse, but we have to turn our attention to the top and see, okay, veganism's growing, awareness is growing, consciousness is growing. Both things are happening at the same time, and it kind of depends where you put your attention. And that's why I think being a part of the vegan movement is so, you know, it's important to put your focus there, because that's what gives us the hope. That's where we see veganism, because it's a solution to so many things, and it's a solution to the root cause of all of this, which is that predatory mindset, you know, that idea that it's okay for other beings to suffer for my pleasures or whatever. Veganism addresses that head on. So because it does that, it becomes a hope for absolutely everything. And I think when people can put their focus there, it just helps us to remember that change is possible.
What role do you think localism plays in terms of growing veganism? In other words, looking at like small, like what's around you in terms of smaller communities, as opposed to the larger kind of globalistic outlook?
That's an interesting question. I mean, here where we are, we're in kind of a semi-rural area, and there is a big movement towards localized food production and, you know, growing of plant foods and this and that. But unfortunately, there's still a very speciesist outlook. So there's a lot of small farms, a lot of small farmers, but there's a lot of people who are slaughtering animals on their own farms, and they think that that's the great solution. We're not importing meat from the mainland. We're doing it here ourselves. And so unfortunately, you know, it's still, it's that underlying speciesism that we've all been conditioned into that needs to be addressed, you know, no matter where you look.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I wanted to make a point that it's not a diet. It's actually a change of your cells in your body, which people don't realize.
Mm-hmm.
For a very minor example of it changes your brain cells, how you think. Like most people, when I was a kid and I had something in the car, I would throw it out the window, you know, to throw it away, whatever away meant, out mm-hmm. of my sight, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there is no away. It's all our planet. But
veganism changes the way
it changes the way you see things. Because now, when I go for a walk, I take a hefty bag and I pick up the garment.
Yep. That's just we do too.
Yeah, just a tiny example of it changes the way you see things. It changes your whole perspective on life. It's much bigger than a diet. It's a totally different way of seeing yourself and others. And it's the true foundation of the golden rule. It's just doing unto others. It's so sad to think, and they're so innocent, these creatures. I mean, the cows still love us. You know, we had a bunch of cows on our land that some woman saved from a dairy that closed down here in Hawaii, and they were sending off their cows to be slaughtered somewhere else. And she saved a bunch of these cows, and we have a piece of land with a lot of great hay on it, great grass. And just the seven, they're like gentle folk, you know, with these big, beautiful eyes. And even if they were home, it gives us no right to hurt them in any way.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very sad reality. And I can't believe when we started, my wife and I, we thought it would take 10 years and America, I wouldn't know about the world, but America would see the truth of it and change, including our friends. Well, of course, that was 50 years ago. That didn't happen. But it is, it's just moving slowly, but it's getting there. I see, even on TV, they used to show tofu like a joke. It was always a joke on a sitcom. And now they have, where somebody in the family is a vegan, they don't mock it anymore. You know, it's like a different way of looking at things. Yeah. It's just all these things I see as positive. And I want to try to get that across to young people who have recently become vegan.
Mm-hmm.
It's the most hopeful thing on this planet. And like Angel said, let's look at it from that end.
I agree. If there was something that people could do to make one difference other than just becoming vegan, like what would be your suggestion in terms of what's an activity or what's an action that people can take to kind of make a difference, feel more positive?
Well, I could tell you a few things we did in the long distant past. You know, they have these airplanes that fly banners behind them with messages. So we were in Florida at the time, and of course they have the spring break down there. So we flew a banner that said, give the animals a spring break, stop eating them. And on Thanksgiving, when all the college kids were there, we said, Thanksgiving is murder on turkeys. And then we would go around, my wife and I, with a microphone like we were reporters, and ask the college kids what they thought of it. And, you know, it's one thing, you never know what the effects are of what you do in life, or at least so far, I don't know. But I assume that some people, you know, you can't expect everybody to change. We used to have free seminars, we still do, but COVID has interrupted that, in which, let's say we had 50 or 60 people come to hear a doctor speak, or my wife speak, or even I spoke at times. And the 50 or 60 people, maybe two or three out of those 50 or 60 would turn vegan, which was a success. You can't expect those who are so hardened into it to change. Change doesn't happen that way. It never has and never will.
Yeah.
It comes from the top down, not the bottom up.
Well, it comes from the inside, right? You can't
from the inside, right?
Yeah.
Not the
outside. Yeah, you gotta.
When we're talking to people about veganism, if people become vegan and they want to help spread the word, we have to look for the right opportunities. It's not you know, we never found that the success was in going out and telling everybody to do it. I mean, we do that on our website. We make it clear that this is what we think is the most important change, and we give people the reasons and the resources and information and such. But the main thing is speaking to the people who are looking for the information, right? And that's what we've tried to do with our visitor program here. It's something we have on hold right now due to COVID, but we made a program where people could come if they were looking for that information. So rather than going out there and trying to, you know, tell it to a whole lot of people who may not respond positively, which can then lead to burnout and make people feel like the world is never going to change, we want to make ourselves available to the people who already are looking for that and are seeking that information, so we can help push them over the edge and help to give them a perspective on veganism that will last. Because, you know, for a lot of people, they might watch a 5-minute video and get shocked, and they maybe try it out. But then a year or two later, if they don't have a really solid understanding of what this is all about, they could just go back to, you know, doing it the old way. So we've tried to take this role of helping people who are already at that point of wanting to do it, and helping to instill in them a really deep understanding so that their veganism will become a lifelong commitment, which is not to say we don't take the opportunity wherever we can to help people open up to veganism. But it's just hard when you try to talk to people who are going to come back and be so argumentative about it because they're just not open, that then, you know, that can become something that actually feels demoralizing and maybe ultimately saps your energy for reaching out to people who are ready to hear it.
Another thing we did in late 80s, I believe, we had two celebrity banquets, which for free, and very on the top level, we had calligraphied invitations, and we invited all the celebrities we could. My nephew at the time was River Phoenix.
Oh.
So of course my nephew now is Joaquin Phoenix. And the whole family, including the grandchildren, are all vegan. His sisters, his kid, their kids, everybody.
He's a great proponent. Yeah.
Yes, he is. And his wife now is an activist. Yeah. That, and anyway, we had a lot of celebrities, many of whom young people wouldn't know, but there was,
Sidney Poitier, Danny Glover,
Sheena Easton, Drew Barrymore, when she was about 16. They all came. We had 21 main dishes from every country, Chinese food, Italian food, Jewish food, in 21 different fancy tents. And then after it was over, we had so much food, we filled Steven Spielberg's freezer. You know, it was funny. These big time people would say, just fill my freezer. They would never say, how much will that cost? It didn't matter to them. Just fill the freezer, and which is what we did. People, for some reason, then were just getting into recycling and looking into veganism a little more, or at least vegetarianism. I don't know what happened to that. But anyway, all these celebrities, we had these banquets for celebrities because, oh, Casey Kasem was a big, he was a beautiful man, by the way, Casey. Hmm. And he and River helped us get these phone numbers and names of, and when we said that they're coming, of course, these other celebrities would come. And we were hoping that these celebrities, like John Candy at the time, we were hoping they would change their diet, unless they're a man like John Candy, who of course died, would lose 100 pounds. And since they influenced so many other people, we were going to influence people who were an influence to other people.
Yeah.
And that's why we had those banquets.
This is before, you know, this common trend of celebrities kind of jumping on the vegan diet bandwagon and sticking with it for a bit and then going back. This was long before any of that. So the idea was that maybe if somebody with such a huge reach could, you know, get on board this movement, then it would maybe just amplify the message tremendously.
Mm-hmm. Well, like Joaquin is doing, I'm sure.
It is, yeah.
I'm sure. No question.
Yeah.
There are people who follow these people. They follow their dress. They follow their, you know, they're these fanatic, no, not fanatic, but they're followers of celebrities. And so if a man stands like Joaquin and says, don't drink milk because they're taking the babies away. I'm sure there are people out there, and not everybody will listen to him, but it was the first time anybody who won an Academy Award said anything that really meant something besides thank you, everybody.
Exactly. And I, you know, part of this is, I think when you're trying to affect social change in a society, a lot of times it's isolating, right? I mean, you have your own limited kind of group of people that you're working with to try to affect the change. But when then you see somebody who is in that perceived leadership of the country, and I would say Cory Booker is like that as well, right? I mean, he's in a political sense kind of playing that role. But Joaquin Phoenix, somebody who's recognizable, but it's not a fluffy thing to him. It's a passionate thing. And right. It's something that identifies his moral center. And I think that there's actually a large number of people who are looking for that moral center, that it's not easily obtained when you are just kind of taking things in from society. And so that kind of leadership really pays dividends because it shows people this is the way to go, follow me, and you know, you end up attracting more people to that cause. It's awesome.
Yeah, that's right. Well, just when he narrated Earthlings alone, yeah. I mean, it's a powerful sequence at the beginning where he just explains what speciesism actually is, which of course is a concept that most people don't even think about. But once you do think about it, it makes a lot of sense and is very illuminating. There was a poll done. It's a long time ago now, but there was some kind of a survey, online survey done to ask people how they became vegan. And of course, a lot of people had read various books, you know, books that a lot of old time readers would be familiar with. But Earthlings was pretty high up in the poll, you know, for people who had actually become vegan as a result of a specific thing that influenced them. And it's true that a lot of people are looking for that. A lot of people don't even know they're looking for it and maybe aren't even looking for it. But, you know, when somebody with as high profile as Joaquin does talk about it, it's going to push it into their consciousness where maybe it wasn't before. And for people who are in the right frame of mind to hear about that, yeah, it's like just kind of throwing a truth bomb out there, and some people are gonna get it.
Yeah, definitely. If people want to learn more about the work that you do and Gentle World, how can they reach out to you? What's the website?
So the website is gentleworld.org, O-R-G. And there we have a contact us form if people want to make contact. We have a newsletter that people can sign up to. We're on social media. The links are there. We're not that active because social media is a strange world and not even so sure how much we want to be involved with it anymore. But we do have a lot of information on our website, and we send out our newsletter to people who sign up. So we certainly welcome people to join the Gentle World community. We'd be excited to hear from some of your listeners, because from your questions, I'm guessing that this is an insightful group of people who are listening to you.
I feel that way. And, you know, I think there's a lot of us who are kind of on the same journey, and, you know, there's no one path. So I think that's the gem in it. But, you know, these are all things that added value to our lives. So I appreciate you for sharing your stories.
Well, we will all meet upon the summit, somebody once said. Even though we're walking different paths to get there, we'll all meet at the summit. I want to put in words, not just the animals we eat, it's the poor elephants and the rhinoceroses and all those.
The fish, the sharks, yeah.
The fish, yeah.
The birds. Animals being experimented on.
The ones who are, yeah, the beagles at the army. Hey.
The horses being raised, the circuses, the animals for fabric.
It's all there.
It's basically all of them, because either we domesticate them and exploit them, or we're wiping out their habitat. It's basically all animals other than humans are suffering under this speciesist regime.
Yeah. And humans are suffering too, though. They're not as aware of it.
Yeah.
That's true too.
Well, they're told they're at the top of the chain, so they don't have to worry. But the reality is, you know,
Yeah, unless they're black.
That's being told to them by the 1%. Yeah, exactly.
Right. Unless they're black or brown or
Or
gay.
woman. Yeah.
Yeah, then they're not at the top anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is definitely a little bit of an asylum here that we need to correct. It's those of us who see the sanity in the world, not the insanity. That's what's got to change. The people who are sane have got to be running things, not those who are insane.
Exactly. There was an interview that I did a while ago with a friend of Ram Dass's, and he left me with, you know, that's it's a matter of choice. You know, you can either be part of the group of light or you can be part of the group of darkness. But it's a matter of choice, and we have choices to make. So just hope people make more right choices.
Yeah, that's right. That's a,
that's the hope.
All right. Well, thanks again for
why anybody would want to make the wrong choice is beyond me.
Well, plenty of people do. We'll have to fix that. Again, thanks for chatting, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you so much, James. Beautiful interview. Really,
it's been
enjoyed
a pleasure.
It.
And I appreciate the opportunity to sit on my backside and get the word out.
Awesome. Well, again, thanks for sharing.
All right, James. Thanks very much.